Pizza No Arba Denver Day, Book 1, Chapter 10. As Wednesday morning wrapped up, I headed back to the warehouse to place my bets and to commit the original sin of succumbing to the desire to spend more time with Sandy Licker. I got there about 12:30. There was a bit of a crowd, as apparently was to be expected, judging by the looks of the scene. The squad was running line-on-line scrimmages, 2-minute runs each with reflects the rules of the sport, 2 minutes per line shift, and score an opportunity with 2 30-minute rounds comprising a match. I saw the guys who'd given me the odds sheet the day before sitting in the same huddle, watching the girls go around. I put 50 on the Lickers for Saturday's match and another 50 on them to win again the following week. My girl Sandy was a defensive player, a blocker. Two of the guys make in books spoke a Russian accent. Not totally unusual accent for bookmakers, but it was pretty auspicious, I thought, in light of the unidentified dead guy in the Russian suit. Although, for all we may ever know, that dude was as American as an apple pie and had plenty of cash to spend on good foreign suits. I made the mental note just in case. Add Russian bookmakers to this bubbling rock and roll stew of strippers and skater ladies at the bottoms of lakes. At about 2 o'clock, they broke up the scrimmage, and I wheeled myself down there and greeted Sandy. I told her the news about the Chino Beavers. Weird, you know, that was their own ambulance. She said, I believe they got a pretty good deal on it, and it was big enough to fit their whole squad into. Besides the obvious general tragedy of it, it's tough for the circuit to lose a whole squad. She said, you get to know the smell and the smiles and the glares and the snarls of your competitors, and it's like puppy love. And there's great respect among athletes, truly. Chivalry. She pouted a little and wiped off a tear. You want to go for another ride? Absolutely, I replied. She unstrapped her skates, laced up her high tops, grabbed her bag, and we headed out to the parking lot. I'll drive again, she said. She grabbed us beverages from the cooler in the back seat of her bug, and we pulled out of the parking lot. About 10 minutes later, we arrived at her studio apartment. Sandy's apartment was like a tiny museum and customized treehouse all rolled into one. There was a bicycle strung up from the ceiling and a few hammocks and some hanging chairs on chains. And the walls were fully coated with a mosaic of articles, paintings, collages, drawings, photographs, and the shelves were filled with books and origami, this and that, everything. Knickknacks, bowls and vases, figurines, fish bowls, rocks, incense, and crystals. The place was alive with stuff crammed into it from corner to corner to corner to corner to corner. And there was a kitchenette to the left of the door, and a pillow-filled niche behind a curtain of beads to the right. We walked back through the beads, and she switched off the light, and the room became almost pitch black. There was not much for sunlight outside anyway, even if the windows hadn't been cloaked with her thick, iridescent curtains. And she kissed me, ordered me bare, removed her uniform, and blew my mind. After about an hour later, she dropped me back off at my car like she was coughing up a hairball. Lopez got off the plane at Phoenix, rented a sedan, and booked a room at a hotel near the airport. He dropped off his carry-on bag in his room and looked at the North Phoenix address he'd been given by MCSO. He drove to the sheriff's office and met with some of the detectives there for about a half hour, and then headed north on I-17 for about 10 minutes. It was about 2:45 when he knocked on the roller apartment door. He told them to expect him at about 3 o'clock. Beccarola answered the door in the roller's baby blue uniform. She and Veronica had just returned from the day's scrimmage. Becca invited him in. And Veronica made tea. Becca was muscular and not very tall, but she was still very attractive. Veronica had already changed out of her uniform into jeans and a plain cotton t-shirt. She was tall with steely blue eyes, although she had a subtle and disarming smile. Fundamental to it, they sat him down at the kitchen table. Lopez looked at the stainless steel teapot. Becca ducked out and came back, quickly showered and changed into plain clothes. And the three sat there and talked for about an hour. I loved Jessica, we both did. She was our partner, and understand that you're talking with her two grieving and recently bereft spouses, Detective, Veronica said. I understand, Lopez answered. She continued. Becca and I met during the Crimson murder trial, and a short time later she shot Bobby Crimson during some heavily intoxicated argument and went to ADC for 18 months, Veronica said. In the meantime, I quit the Navajo force and moved out here to Phoenix. Then, when Becca was paroled, she moved in with me. And a few years later, we met Jessica through the bank track circuit. And we fell in love with her, and she moved in with us about 2 years ago. And she continued, still. But I keep in touch with Alan Crimson, and in the last decade, the Crimson and Martinez families have stayed in touch and visit on holidays. You have to hold on to the good of what you still have, or else you have nothing left. So Alan Crimson didn't have, he would never have, anything to do with this. Nobody conjured this up. Jessica's death was a random bar fight dust-up that ended wrong. A crime of dull passion and a meaningless jackass bar fight. I was there. It was one of those things that just gets squirrely and end up wrong. I sat there in my car smoking. I'd asked Sandy about the Russian bookmakers. She said they were just part of the scenery, and that anyway, it was only natural for people to enjoy betting on fast, round and round rolling pretties. I told her that one of our two 11 October dead dudes had a Russian tailor-made suit on, but he carried no identification, and that it looked like somebody was not going to claim his body. And I mentioned that maybe she'd bring it up to some of the Russian wallflowers hanging at the Liggers warehouse, and as that might inspire somebody to mosey into the morgue and claim a comrade. It was about 4 when I got back to the office. You have a certain air about you, Ricky, McKinney said. And by the way, Dixie called. And Oakland wants you to ring them back too. They said, just whenever you get a moment. I dialed up Dixie first. I finally had a call about an hour ago on the dude in the suit, she said, and the person on the line did have a Russian accent. It was a man. He said he'd be around in the next couple of days to identify the body. He did not give me his name or relationship to our guy, and he didn't say when exactly he'd be by, and he hasn't been here yet, she said. Well, I'll stay nearby, call me the instant anyone shows up, and I offered, and I told her the bookmakers for our own town's Davy Jones Liquors were Russians, it seemed, and that, by the way, a whole team of Derby girls had, in other news, crashed their ambulance and drowned in San Francisco Bay the night before. And keep all that in mind for what it's worth, I advised. Yeah, right, Rick, Dixie answered. I rang up Oakland next, and those boys had a fucking doozy. I don't know what else to have called it. Chief Detective Sam Wilson of the Oakland PD. I really don't know how to explain, he said. I feel funny putting it into words, Detective, so I'll just say it. You know, we pulled all those dead girls out of the drink this morning, and, well, one of them, the one in the driver's seat, was all furry all over. And what did he mean by all furry, I wondered. What do you mean by all furry, I asked. I mean all 5'4" of her fucking furry with furry fur, and with dog's teeth and paws, moreover, and 8 nipples. Pointy ears of the whole schmear, Wilson said. She was wearing the Chino Beavers uniform with the nickname Fire Pie stitched in the skirts, but I can think of more appropriate nicknames after seeing what I saw this morning in that uniform. Now, our coroner, quite frankly, is fucking completely mystified. Several Alameda County coroner's office staff, several deputies, the medics, the city police who came in with the drowned women stared at the furry oddity on the autopsy table with great bated, enhanced curiosity and general prolonged disbelief and astonishment. The hair looked coarse, but it was soft to the touch, like an Italian beard. They had removed the uniform she'd drowned in. It was a black and pink miniskirt and a black and white plaid sports support tank top, and her matching canvas high tops sat on the lab table next to her uniform. Her 19 teammates were bagged up in there also, but this surprise from nature was, not surprisingly, getting all of the attention. And like a felled moose, Her tongue lolled out of her mouth and trails of salt water and saliva darkened the fur on her cheeks. She's beautiful, the assistant coroner mooned. Look at those native female features. That soft, shiny coat. Standing next to him, one of his colleagues was chomping at the bit to get the autopsy underway. Curious of her innards. Eyes wide, everybody else looked on. So when their guy put a scalpel into her torso, she shuddered with a shock, unexpectedly. To everyone's surprise, and instinctively everyone standing around the table jumped backwards several feet. Except for the coroner staffer who made the incision, and he couldn't jump because his neck was in her mouth and she was shaking her head back and forth with hydraulic violence. A fine, misty spray of blood began darkening and darkening and further darkening the walls of and the surfaces of pretty much everything else in the room like a coat of spray paint, thickening and thickening. And as she fanned her mouthful back and forth, she was also sucking as she shook her head, and that was also quite very audible to the others in the room through her freaky growl, sucking blood out of his neck as she killed him and shook him. The assistant coroner, when her breakfast was finally all spazzed out and all his juices were everywhere but in him, she dropped the corpse, moved toward the blood-soaked door, and walked out. The men in the room stood there for several very, very long moments, covered in the blood of their deceased colleague, and all looking at the door through which just exited the object of her victim's autopsy. An autopsy that had arguably gotten more out of hand than any other autopsy in the history of autopsies.